Prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did ya? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow, now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast with host A. Trunk.
What's up, everybody? It's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. News-making interviews with the biggest names in rock. And as always, all the interviews you hear on the podcast happen live on my Sirius XM radio show, Trunk Nation. Be sure to check it out Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern, Faction Talk, Sirius XM Channel 103, or anytime on the Sirius XM app, live or on demand. And please be sure to visit the website, SiriusXM.com/Trunk Nation. For info, updates, and how you can listen to the show every day. This week on the podcast, a couple recent interviews from artists who are currently on the road. We'll start with Tom Kiefer. I hosted a couple shows with Tom a couple weeks ago in Wichita and Oklahoma City, sounding phenomenal. Couple dates left on his current U.S. run. Be sure to get out there and see him if you get the opportunity to do so. Truly still at the top of his game. So we'll visit with Tom to get started. And then second in the podcast, Jeff Pilson talking about his band, The End Machine. And of course, Pilson has been the main guy in Foreigner now for, I think, about 20 years. Foreigner inducted or nominated, maybe inducted by the time you hear this, into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We talk about that and his thoughts on that. We talk about Foreigner continuing in 2024. And Foreigner just announced more tour dates coming soon, later on this year, with Loverboy and Lita Ford. So a lot going on with Foreigner. Good time to catch up with Jeff Pilson. We'll do that second. We'll get started with the voice and songwriter and guitarist of the band Cinderella. Tom Kiefer kicks us off this week. Tom, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing good, Eddie. How are you, man?
I'm good. Looking forward to seeing you in a couple weeks in Wichita and Oklahoma City. And you kind of been doing this where you kind of go out for like a cluster of 2-3 weeks and then go away for a little while and then come back, and you've kind of been rolling like that as far as playing live. Is that basically how it works best for you these days?
Well, the last 2 years we've done mainly the summer. We've gone out and done, like, you know, 2 month legs, the Sonic Slam in 22. And then last year we started the Live Loud tour, and we really only did the summer. But this year, we're taking Live Loud, and we're trying to go to some of the places that we didn't get to last year, like Florida. We just went down there in, I guess it was January, and did, you know, hit some dates in Florida. And now we haven't been out west for, you know, since 2019. So we're gonna roll out with Live Loud, you know, March and April for that. But then we have another big block of dates coming in the summer. There are going to be a bunch of markets, towns, cities that we didn't hit last year with Live Loud. So it's just kind of where, you know, it's not necessarily the how we do things, you know, it's just where the, you know, the agent lands the dates, I guess. But we do try to do blocks of dates where we can just get on a bus and go for a while.
Yeah, the run you got coming up, as I mentioned, starts in Wichita on the 29th, Oklahoma City on the 30th, and then you are going west. You got Phoenix, Tucson, Southern California in there. And then you got Vegas in there as well. Last date's announced now on April 11th. So people that haven't seen you, has it been a while since you've been west?
Yeah, 2019 was the last time we were out there. So it'll be a different set than they saw the last time we were out there. We changed that up actually last year. And we'll be doing the set that we did on the Live Loud tour last year. But like I said, we're in different places this year. So that's what we'll be doing out west. And then, like I said, in the summer, there's a bunch of about 6 or 7 weeks of dates we're about to announce. That's the same thing where we're taking it to cities that we haven't been to yet on this tour.
And we should mention on the dates, I know the first two, I'm not sure if it's the whole run, but you've got LA Guns with you again, right?
Yeah, they're on most of the shows. I think there's only a couple that we're doing on our own when we go out west. So that run of dates from the end of March to mid-April, LA Guns are on pretty much all of them. So, and they're definitely on, they're on the two that you're going to be joining us in Wichita and Oklahoma City.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Do you have a lot of history with those guys, Tom? Do you go back with Phil and Tracy to some degree?
No, you know, I've met them. We've done some festivals here and there together, but we started touring together, you know, in 22 is really the first time we toured together when we did. That was our first tour back after the pandemic, and we put together that package with LA Guns and Faster Pussycat that year, and that was a great, great tour. We had a lot of fun. And really, you know, it's the first time we ever toured together. I've always been a big fan, and we hit it off really well, and the combination of the two bands seemed to be something that people liked together. So, you know, they did some dates with us last year too, so we've kind of, you know, it's a good pair up, and we, you know, the bands get along really well, and the fans seem to like that combination of bands. So we have some more with them in the summer too this year, so it's becoming a favorite of us, and I think for them too.
Well, it's a good bill, and it makes sense. And what I love about it as a fan of actually live music and actually live playing and singing is that you guys are all very, very organic and totally real live bands, and I have a lot of appreciation for that, as you know. So I think that's a good aspect of it, too. And Phil and Tracy, since they got back together, I don't know what it's been now, 10 years or so ago, they've made some great records in the live shows, and the band has been killer. I mean, I see them almost as much, if not more, than I see you play. And every time they deliver, and it's really good live. So it makes sense. It's a good bill.
Oh, they're killer. They're absolutely killer. And and they're all live. And, you know, Tracy's an amazing guitarist. Really love hearing him play every night. And Phil sounds amazing. Their songs are great. So, yeah, like I said, I've always been a fan, and they always do bring it. They kick ass. So looking forward to doing some more shows with them this year for sure.
Tom, you referenced a few minutes ago the set list and how you've changed it up a little bit. What goes into, for you, what goes into making the set list for this band? Because you've got the two studio records, which obviously you want to represent, and then you know, yeah, the bulk of the people in there want to hear Cinderella songs, and you've got those four records to pull from. So there's songs, of course, you have to do every night, I know, but beyond those songs, what goes into it for you is saying, hey, let's do this tonight? Or do you, when you start a run, do you just lock into the same set, or might you call audibles on any given night?
It's hard for us to call audibles, and I'll go back even to Cinderella days too. It's hard to call audibles because there's so many different guitar tunings and guitar tones and guitar changes that started with Cinderella, where, you know, the techs are as integral with some of the, I mean, you've seen us, you know, Tony's juggling three guitars at once and I'm changing guitars every song, or sometimes two different guitars in one song. So you do kind of have to orchestrate it and in a way where, you know, the set pacing works and that the guitar changes work to get, you know, the right tuning in my hand or Tony's hand at the time. So that makes it hard to just say, hey, you know, the hell with it. Let's, you know, call an audible tonight, because they all kind of flow together. And there's a, you know, it's the techs kind of have to learn the set as much as we do, to make sure that, you know, the right tuning is handed to me or to Tony at the right time. So that's kind of always a challenge. So that's why there's not usually a lot of audibles, because there's just so many different tunings and tones and stuff going on from song to song. Other than that, you know, the most important thing to me in a set is to pace it, where, you know, you come out and you kind of hit it hard, and then, you know, you give those breaths here and there where, you know, you, the energy goes up and then it comes down a little bit to give up some relief, and then it goes back up again. And with each time that it goes up, you want to pace it in a way where it goes up a little higher than it did the last time before you take that breath again with a ballad or something. And, you know, the goal is always, you know, by the back third of the set, that the thing's just on fire. and the people are with you because, you know, you haven't maybe worn them out in the front half of the set by not pacing things well, if that makes sense. So I think that that's the biggest consideration. And, you know, the songs are, you know, like you said, there's some songs that are, you know, these you just have to play. And I don't mean that like you have to. I mean, I like playing them. I still love playing those hits. And people want to hear the new music, too. So we try to change it out every tour or every couple tours where we're shifting things around. And, you know, last year we added a couple things that hadn't been played in years, like Heartbreak Station and Hot and Bothered. And we have a song off of the Rise record that we hadn't played live yet that we added in Life Was Here, which is in the set now. So, yeah, I mean, it's you try to rotate songs out from year to year and, you know, and make the pacing work where it really builds, you know, where the show really builds.
You know, I think about when you first started doing this and you came back with the first record and The Way Life Goes, and you kind of, you know, how to... You really, in a way, even though you're Tom Kiefer from Cinderella and it's billed as Cinderella's Tom Kiefer, I mean, you still had to build this thing. It was a new band. It was new people. You had to let people know what you were doing. You had to let them know that you're still going to do Cinderella songs, but you're also going to do some of your solo stuff as well. How challenging was that for you? And how challenging is it still? Because, I mean, I've been to the shows. They're fantastic. You draw great crowds. But, you know, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I still get people that call my show every day and like, oh, man, when's he going to do Cinderella again? And I always say, well, he wrote the songs. He sang the songs. He played most of the guitar on all the songs, not to diminish what the other guys did. But I'm like, just go see this. But, you know, there's going to be a segment of people that without that logo and branding, they're just like, oh, I want to see Cinderella. So how challenging is that for you? And do you feel that's maybe dissipated to some degree now that you've stayed with this for so long?
Well, it was certainly challenging in the beginning. And I think it is for anyone who, you know, starts something new outside of, you know, the band that they started with, I guess. So it was definitely challenging in some ways. More on the touring side when we first started, from a radio standpoint, you know, we had solid ground. You know, I didn't expect that. Like, I thought, like, when we went out that it would be pulling teeth at radio to get a record played and hit the charts with a single, and that touring was going to be a no-brainer, and it turned out to be the other way around. Solid ground shot up the charts. The record was a lot easier to work than it was working the you know, touring live. That's the thing that took a little longer to build for all the reasons you just stated. But I think over time, you know, that seems to be less of a challenge. You know, the shows, the offers for shows in terms of the size venues and stuff that we're getting, you know, it's just kind of grown over the years. So, but it makes sense to me now in retrospect.
It makes sense to you in what way? That it was challenging initially or that people still
now? Yeah, that it would take a minute to, you know, kind of build that and for people to understand what it is and, you know, for the reputation of the new band to spread. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, and it is a killer band for people that haven't seen it. I mean, you've been out there doing it for a while now, but it's just so good. And again, I'm just always reinforcing to people that you are still obviously honoring the Cinderella legacy and still playing those songs and now again, it's actually in the billing. You're billed as Cinderella's Tom Kiefer. So that should alleviate any confusion that there may be. New music going forward. You've got the two records out, Rise being the most recent. Have you written or thought about recording another record yet?
Yeah. I mean, at some point there'll be one, you know, it's, you know, just inspiration hits at the oddest times. You know, when the first solo record was released, we were so focused on touring that, you know, I just thought, man, I'm never going to write another song again. The inspiration's not coming, and I don't know when we're ever going to get another record done. And then for some strange reason, when we got off the road in 2018, we just ended up in the studio and all these songs just fell out and we had Rise like in about 6 months time, you know, between the writing and the recording and mixing and all. So, you know, I feel that coming again, You know, I think that we all want to make another record, and there's definitely some ideas for some songs starting to drift into the antenna, you know. That's how it always starts for me, is you get ideas for songs and you sing them into a voice memo or you jot down a line. And you just kind of, I don't usually finish them when they come to me that way. I just kind of store these ideas. And then at some point, you got a pile of them. You go, oh, let's go make a record. And then you finish out the songs and you record them. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, that process is going on all the time, you know, of just like collecting the ideas. You get an inspiration, you know, driving down the road and you pull out the voice memo and you sing a chorus line into something. And you don't come back to it for, you know, who knows how long, but usually you come back to when you have a pile of those and then you finish them out.
Were there any songs on either of the two solo records that you had sat on for a long time that were maybe even written back for a Cinderella record that you just had sitting and then you thought was the right time to finish them off when you did those records?
Yeah, I mean, there's some. I mean, some of the songs, or actually quite a few of the songs on the first solo record had been originally demoed with Cinderella for a record deal that went very south that I'm not allowed to talk about. because, you know, it kind of ended up in a lawsuit and stuff. So I think you know what I'm referring to. But so then at that point, you know, we were restricted from recording those songs. There's a re-record restriction and all, and, you know, all that stuff. So that's when I went and took those same songs and recorded them for a solo record. And you know, I've told that story before, so that's not any new information there. But, you know, some of those songs on the first record I had written, and they were originally demoed for the Cinderella record that was never released because of that lawsuit. So now on Rise, most that stuff's all new. That was all written after, you know, it was written between when the first record was released. All those song ideas kind of came along between the release of the first record and when we did Rise.
Yeah, because I don't think fans realize if you had a record that was shelved, and I know another artist that's dealing with this right now, and even though they're your songs and you wrote those songs, there could be a period of time where you can't re-record them to get around the fact that they were originally intended for another record, right? There's a period,
depending upon
the contract, where they're kind of frozen out from you completely. And that's what happened with some of the stuff that ended up on The Way Life Goes. It had passed the point where you could then revisit it and then re-record it.
Well, no, actually, I could immediately because the restriction was on the band re-recording.
Oh, I see.
So I was able to, you know, go in and record them. And actually, I waited a few years, but, you know, I forget what the re-record restrictions are. It was like 5 years or more. So, you know, it was a shame to just have those songs sitting. So...
a good song is a good song. No matter when it comes out, you want to get it out there.
Yeah.
So it sounds like to me, your process as a writer is that you compile things and then you sit down and say, okay, now I really got to piece this together. So you're gathering ideas as you go, you're making these voice memos, but then when you're really going to hone in on making a record, you're going to sit down and then you're really going to, do you block everything else out at that point and just focus on finishing the songs and writing the songs?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of when it gets serious, you know. And like that comes when you feel like you got a bunch of ideas because you don't want to go with the first 10 ideas you have, you know. So then you know, feel like, whoa, this is really starting to pile up. Okay, and then you go through and you pick, like, what are the best ideas here? And, you know, with the solo stuff, I write most of it with Savannah, and she writes the same way, and she stockpiles ideas. And we just get to a point where we, like on Rise, we just started kicking ideas back and forth at each other, and then before we knew it they were finished, you know. But yeah, that's the point where you got to block the rest of the world out, you know. And that's what happened when we got off tour in 2018, and I had a ton of ideas and Savannah had some ideas, and we kind of were going through them, and you know, boom, it's like we just started finishing. It was like, man, that's a great idea, let's finish that one. And then, you know, next thing I know, I'm up in the studio with the band and we're tracking them. And that record went really fast, you know, compared to the first one, which took 10 years, better part of 10 years. putting that one together, and it was recorded with session musicians and stuff. And it was just, there were a lot of obstacles that came into play with that record, but we eventually got it done and sounding the way we wanted it. And then, you know, very pleasant surprise when we made Rise, it was the opposite experience. I mean, there were like no obstacles. It was like, all right, we're making a record, block the world out, boom, all of a sudden it's done.
Yeah.
So that was, it was kind of like, you know, it's like every record's different. Every record's different.
I'm always so interested in the songwriting process. And one more question on that. When you wrote all these Cinderella songs that are big hits, whether it's Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone, Shake Me, Gypsy Road, Somebody Save Me, Heartbreak Station, whatever it was, was there one that surprised, like when you write a song, like any of those that I mentioned, or maybe some of the bigger ones I didn't either, do you know when you write it and record it, does it feel like, did you know those songs were going to be these big enduring songs that were going to become at some point classic rock and that were going to be these big hits? Or does it surprise you sometimes when a song that goes on that you wrote becomes really big because you didn't think much of it at the time? Like, can you give me some examples of that, of maybe like one you wrote that you were shocked became a big song, and maybe one that you wrote that you thought was going to be a big song and it didn't do anything?
Well, I mean, obviously the first record, Shake Me and Nobody's Fool, you know, I wasn't thinking about them becoming classic rock songs, or, you know, there was a total shock, you know, that, you know, Shake was released and the record went gold and then Nobody's Fool, you know. So, you know, all of that was like, you don't see that coming. You don't really think about that when you're writing songs. To me, you know, I just, when I'm writing a song, it's like, I'll say to myself, I think this is good, or this is something, you know, I like this, but I don't know if anyone else is going to like it. So see, with the release of the first record, you know, I think we, Night Songs, I think we all felt pretty good about what we had, but, you know, it was our first record and who knows, and boom, the thing blew up. And I would say that, you know, going into Long Call Winter and even the subsequent records that we released, it's not really thinking about that when you're writing them, you're just trying to get down on tape the emotion that you felt when you were writing that song. And, you know, how do you pull that out of the speakers? Because that's a whole other process than just writing. Like, writing's a lot easier than capturing that feeling and emotion that you want coming out of the speakers. That's hard. Harder. Writing flows. And then it's like, well, how do you capture this? You know, what's the right instrumentation? What's the right production? What's the right energy here? Is it, you know, a ballad? Is it heartbreak? Is it angry? Is it, you know, so that's a whole other process. So you're kind of lost in all of that when you're doing it. And there's a lot of self-doubt, you know, when you start hearing the stuff coming back through the speakers. And so, no, I mean, I don't, to get to your question, no, I'm not really thinking about that, you know. And it's when the songs that have taken off and have, you know, have done really well, at that point, it's just, I don't know, just like gratitude. It's like, wow, you know, it's, you know, you just feel fortunate that someone else liked what you were hearing in your head and what you tried to pull out of those speakers in the studio. So, yeah, it's not really a consideration. Like I said, I think most artists, you know, when they're making records, there's a lot of self-doubt, you know, because you're so close to it. I guess that's the best way to put it. You're so close to it. You're not thinking about, is this going to be classic rock down the road? Or, you know, you're just in there trying to figure out how to make it sound the way you want it to. So I think that's part of the creative process. And I think a lot of artists would probably tell you the same thing, that we're in the throes of creating. You know, there's a process there where you're so close to things that there's a lot of self-doubt going on.
Yeah, but I gotta think, and if you remember, like, the very first time you heard the finished mixed playback of something like Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone, you I would think that that's got to hit you like, wow, I just, that's really something special. I mean, do you remember that moment? Do you remember?
I would say, yeah,
your thoughts,
yeah,
I
will say that one. And certainly not during the process of creating it, but I do remember sitting in front of my speakers at the studio when it was all mixed, mastered, and we were a couple of months out from the process. And I was just kind of listening to, it might have been when I was listening to the mastering, and Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone came on. And I just remember thinking, I think we got all of that one. That's one example that I could say, you know, but again, that was after the writing process and the recording process, and it was all done. And I remember when that kind of, you know, I had like probably, they called them acetates from the mastering lab. It's like a hard vinyl that they give you to approve. And I was listening to it right off of the acetate or whatever, you know, which is the format that they give you to approve it. It kind of looks like vinyl. And I do remember with that one, you know, I thought, you know, we did good on that one.
And then the next thing you know, you're on top of a mountain playing a piano to a music video.
In the freezing
too.
It's like, cold. And they left that part out, you know.
Oh, where was that?
Northern Mono Lake in Northern California. Oh, we're going to Northern California. It's like, I'm picturing like warm weather because it's California, right? And it was like, I mean, it was like sub degrees. And they were trying to capture sunsets and sunrises. So the only civilization was pretty, you know, I want to say almost an hour away. So, you know, the calls for the shoot on that were like 4 a.m., you know, because we had to get up driving the van out to this desolated lake that had, you know, drained, all the water had drained out of it. And, you know, to catch the sunrise, and I was freezing. It was freezing. But I got to say that the director, you know, it's a great location. It had a great feel for that song, I think. I think he captured a cool image. It was very different from the video at the time, I thought.
Yeah.
I think he did a good job. So it was worth getting a frostbite on that piano sitting out in the middle of nowhere.
And those were the days when music videos were music videos. I mean, that's when you guys all were really going for it. But it was different for the time. And that was the days, too, where those things were not cheap. Do you remember the budget on that video? Remember what that one cost you?
I don't remember the exact number. But, I mean, it's insane what you can make now for a fraction
right.
of the price. But, no, I mean, those videos were, like, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, I mean, I don't know the exact price of what that one was, but it was ridiculous what they cost.
Yeah. There were no drones. There were no drones back then to get those overhead shots.
We had helicopters and, you know, so technology has allowed things to be a little bit easier. You know, I still love making videos, and we've had some really good video directors we've worked with on the solo records. But it's just, you know, astonishing how much cheaper you can do a pretty good looking video. You know, it's crazy. But
hey,
that's a creative process that I enjoy. You know, I think it's kind of cool to bring the song to life. You know, visually, it's a cool art form.
Yeah, it's interesting how the place videos have now than when they, you know, back when that was done in the Cinderella days, because videos now, you know, videos then were the ultimate. I mean, they moved the needle. They were more impactful than even radio play back at that time. But it's interesting what's happened with videos now, because you can make them more affordably, and now everybody can see them on demand on YouTube or on websites. And I see, like, there's a few artists, like I was talking to Nuno last week on the Monsters Cruise, and he was telling me they're going to do a video for every song from the new Extreme record. So you can do that now because it's more affordable and your fans can see it. And it's another way to kind of keep the record alive, to have that visual element for every song. I don't know, as a songwriter, if you want to create a visual for every song on your record, how you would feel about that. But it is, I mean, Bon Jovi did it as well, like for a record a couple records ago. So there are people that are doing different things with video, because it's now, although it's maybe harder to find them because everybody can make them and it's not like gather around the MTV for the premiere anymore, it still holds a pretty important place, I think.
No, I think it does. And, you know, most importantly, you know, it's, you make the music and you create the art, whether it's video or music or whatever, you know, for the fans and for yourself, you know. So it's, you know, if videos don't get as much attention as they used to or move as many records as they did with MTV, it's like, you know, it's still fun to make them, you know. It's like the artist in you wants to still create and the fans like to see it. So, but I think it does help to you know, as you said, keep records alive, you know, if you could keep releasing them. I think on Rise, we've done almost every song on there, and we have actually another one about to come out from that record. But yeah, it's as long as it's good, you know, and we try to, you know, just not put out things for the sake of putting them out. You know, the directors and stuff that we work with do really good videos and good work. So we try to keep the quality control up and just not, you know, go for quantity, I guess.
All right. Hey, two quick things and I'll let you go. How's your voice doing? Because, you know, you referenced before The Way Life Goes and how long it took. And for those that don't know, part of that was because you really battled through some stuff as far as getting your voice together. I just saw you last at Rock Island in Key West. Sounded amazing. I've seen you many times, always sounding great. But do you feel confident that all that is behind you? Have you had any issues since everything you went through?
You know, I would say that it seems to get stronger with each tour. I still work the voice technique stuff that Ron Anderson taught me. And I work it every day. I get on tour and it's, you know, the condition I have is permanent. So it's not like it's cured, but what he taught me is how to support my voice to get around that partial paralysis. So, and he told me when he taught it to me, he said, you know, this takes a person with, it's opera technique that he taught me and core support. And he said, you know, for a person with a healthy voice, this takes 10 years to master. Well, I started working with him in 2009 and I did not have a healthy voice. I have, you know, a neurological condition. So it seems like it's getting stronger with each year. You know, the more I do that and the more shows that I do. Yeah. So knock on wood and cross fingers that it continues in that direction. But I mean, I'm still anxious as hell about it every night. You know, it's like, but you know, that's just, you know, part of it, you know, being nervous and anxious and all that stuff keeps you on your toes.
Have you noticed your voice changing at all with getting older? Because for some people it does. And then others, I mean, I just saw Glenn Hughes a week ago and he sounds like he was when he was 22. It's crazy. So have you noticed any changes you've gotten older?
No, I think mine changed more from the condition that I had, the neurological condition, and it's taken me years to kind of get that back. And the more I'm more or less mastering the technique that I was taught, where it helps me to get around that problem, it seems like it's getting stronger and stronger and getting closer to being back to where it was, you know, before I had the issue. So. And like I said, prayers and knock on wood and fingers crossed that continues. Because once you go through that experience, you know, where you lose your instrument, there's always a little something in the back of your head, you know, no matter how well things are going. I'm just being honest, you know.
No,
but
I get it.
You know. So, yeah, but like I said, that, you know, sometimes fear is the best motivator. So I don't miss a warm-up. Or a cool down after a show. Never.
So. Right, right. Hey, last thing. So before you came on the air with me, I had a story that I was talking about with my audience about the fact that there's going to be a Spinal Tap sequel, which I'm super excited about. 40 years after the original movie, they're shooting it now. Same cast, mm-hmm. Rob Reiner and all of that. I was telling my audience that there were some people that weren't such a fan initially when they saw Spinal Tap because it hit a little too close to home the first time they watched it. What were your thoughts of the original Spinal Tap when you saw it? And what is your personal biggest Spinal Tap story, if you can share it with the audience?
Well, I thought the movie was hilarious. I loved it. I thought that there was a lot of truth to it.
Right.
And I would have to say, I actually did have a Spinal Tap moment. It was on the Long Cold Winter tour. And I don't know if I've ever told you this one before. I've told the story before, but remember in the movie, when they're in the pods and the pod wouldn't open at the beginning of the show.
Of course.
And the guy comes out and he's banging on it with a hammer.
Yes.
So Long Cold Winter, our entire stage was covered with black drapes that were on like pulleys. The crew would pull them up to reveal the stage at a certain point. And that point was the downbeat of Falling Apart at the Seams. So we had this big dramatic intro tape that made you feel like you were going to, that it was going to, you know, we're going to hit you with something really hard. And then it just peaks and a curtain got pulled off of me and I'm up on a platform and there's just spotlights on me and I've got a dobro, the harmonica, and a microphone. And I start playing the acoustic blues, Bad Seamstress Blues. So it just completely not what you're expecting from the intro tape. And then when we get to the end of that and I say, let's go, you know, I had the electric strap on and I would just kind of hit the chord and the band would start playing Falling Apart at the Seams and the crew would pull the rest of the drapes off. So one night, I think it was in Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi. When they pulled the cord to pull the drape off of me, I had the dobro was attached to a stand and the harmonica was attached. I rigged this up myself with a coat hanger to the dobro because it was all one thing. And the curtain grabbed the tuning peg of the dobro and pulled it up in the air just out of reach over my head. And I'm standing there with 12 house spots on me. And there's a dobro on a stand with a harmonica attached to it with a coat hanger dangling over my head. And I'm reaching up trying to grab it. And I finally got the bottom of the stand and I'm pulling on it. And the guy backstage pulling the rope didn't know what was going on. And he's pulling from the other side. So it's just like this tug of war. I finally just let go of it. And by this point, the rest of the band are looking around the side of the curtains. And I just looked at them and counted 1, 2, 3, 4. And we just went into Falling Apart at the Seams. But, you know, I imagine the audience when it first happened, you know, it's like all these spots on me and there's this like flying dobro over my head. And it's like, you know, what's Tom doing, a magic trick, like making the dobro fly, you know, because if you they hadn't seen the show before, so they don't know.
Right.
You know, what's going on. So, yeah, that was hilarious.
Did you ever get lost going to a stage?
Yeah, probably more times than, you know, you care to remember. But, yeah, some of them are kind of tricky. So, but I never ran into B.B. King backstage. And he didn't. B.B. King never showed up and said, you guys are musicians, you're authorized, right?
Oh, God, I can't wait to see what the sequel has. It's supposedly the storyline of the sequel is that it's been 40 years. They are all broke and they hate each other, but they got to get back together to do a reunion tour for the money. So that also hits pretty close to home for a lot of bands.
You get the best humor is the stuff that's hits the closest to home, you know.
So, right.
Yeah.
Right,
I mean, I'm sure it'll be great. I'm sure it'll be good.
Well, listen, man, I appreciate the time. Go to TomKiefer.com. Keep up with all the dates. As Tom said earlier, there's dates out there now, but more about to be announced for the summer. If you're on the West Coast, you're finally going to get the Tom Kiefer Band out there. Agora Hills at the Canyon Club, April 5th, and at the Saban in Beverly Hills, April 6th. And then you've got San Juan Capistrano, April 7th, Coach House, Ramona Main Stage, April 9th. So a lot of California. You got Vegas in there, April 11th. And certainly don't want to forget that first two shows of this run, I'll be out there hosting with you guys. LA Guns on these dates as well. Wichita, Kansas, next show up, March 29th. The Cotillion, March 30th, Diamond Ballroom in Oklahoma City. And my buddy Danny Zalisco, this is probably his show, so he'll kill me if I don't mention Phoenix on April 2nd, Celebrity Theater, Tucson at the Rialto on April 3rd. So, Tom, always great to visit with you and great to talk and look forward to seeing you in Wichita in a couple weeks.
Yeah, looking forward to it, man. Can't wait to go hit the road again here, brother. Thanks for having me on.
Anytime, man. All the best to the family.
Thanks, bro.
See ya. Well, thanks to Tom. Just had a chance to see him play live. Sounding amazing. The band is amazing. Be sure to get there early. LA Guns opening and turning in a great set as well. Next up on the podcast, Jeff Pilson. You know him best as the bassist from Dokken, but really for the last 20 years, you probably know him best as the musical director of Foreigner. A lot going on with Foreigner, farewell tour, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nomination, and Jeff also talks about a band he has on the side called The End Machine. Second interview for you this week on the podcast, here's Jeff Pilson. JP, how are you, buddy?
I'm great, Eddie. Good to talk to you.
I'm going to just miss you, man. I'm in Vegas, and I know you guys are about to start up here, right, with Foreigner.
Yeah, I go there tomorrow. You're right. I'm just going to miss you.
We're like ships passing. You're going to be, you guys playing the Venetian? Are you doing a run there?
We're doing a residency at the Venetian. Actually, we're doing two residencies at the Venetian this year. We're doing one starting Friday, eight shows up till April 6th, I think, is the last one. April 6th is the last one. And then we have one in November, end of October and November. So, yeah, exciting year.
Hopefully I can be – I live part-time in Vegas now. Hopefully I can make the second residency. It's been a while since I've seen you guys. I think the last time was I went to a show you did in Denver because I was in Denver for something, and it was when you were out with Whitesnake. I think it was the last time I saw the band, actually.
Yes, and I well, I don't remember exactly, but that sounds right.
Well, no, you've done about 500 shows since then, so I don't expect you to remember.
Right.
So totally. Hey, I know we want to talk about The End Machine here, but before we get to that, just speaking of Foreigner, I know that Mick announced recently that this is pretty much going to be the last go-round when you guys go through this year. Your thoughts on that? You know, are you good with that decision? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, well, actually, what's really happening is that we're no longer, this is the last year that we're going to do a full-on tour that lasts 9 months of the year, one of those kind of deals. This is the last year we're going to do that. We will still do some dates in 25. They're going to be select, probably more corporate, maybe some casinos, but much, much lighter schedule, way lighter schedule. So it's not over with yet. And there's also some music that we're going to try and finish up in 2025, which would be great. Some songs that have been kicking around that we need to finish. So how do I feel about it? I feel, you know, it's a little bit bittersweet because the band is really good right now. It's like really a great family, and it's a great band that listens to each other and kicks butt. And I really enjoy everything about the band and everybody around us, our crew, everyone. But I'm sure going to like not being on the road 9 months of the year. That's going to be great, and I'm ready for that. So bittersweet, but mostly good.
When did you join Foreigner? How long ago?
2004. It's 20 years.
So you got 20 years. I mean, I was saying on the air, I think you're definitely the longest tenured member. And I mean, when you got into the band in 04, did you ever envision it becoming what it's been the last 20 years? I mean, and resurrecting this music and playing it with this band and the reaction to it and the response to it? I mean, did you think it was going to last that long?
Absolutely not. No. I mean, I'll tell you, the energy when we first got together in 2004, and especially in 2005 when Kelly joined, the energy was so intense, and Mick was really excited and motivated, and everybody was just very, you know, very passionate about it. And so I wasn't surprised when it started to take off, and you could see signs of it as soon as we started playing. Then in 2006, we went to Europe and started resurrecting it there because, you know, nobody wanted to hear about us when we first went over to Europe in 2006. But we really built that up into a very strong situation. So I started to see the signs as we were doing it. But no, when I joined, Phil Carson sold it to me as Weekend Warrior work. So
yeah, Phil being the manager. Yeah, I mean, so much for that.
Yeah, I didn't envision what ended up happening, but pretty soon on, it felt like, wow, this is really working. These songs are really connecting, and you know, we've got a great band, and when that happens, man, there's magic, and that's the whole deal.
Well, you got a great band, but the other thing is you've got timeless, amazing songs that a great band is playing. And I equate a lot of what you guys have pulled off here with Foreigner, because everybody knows, and Mick had a statement lately that, you know, he's not really going to be able to play with the band much, if at all, and he really hasn't for a while. But what you guys are doing are so amazingly great renditions of incredible songs. And I kind of parallel a little bit of what you guys are doing now with what Skynyrd does, because I just saw Skynyrd. And Skynyrd, same deal. I mean, the way they're constituted now, there are no original members, but they come out and they say, hey, we are here paying tribute and honoring the great music of Lynyrd Skynyrd. Hope you enjoy it. And it's just friggin' great because the songs are so great and they're still playing them so great. Damon Johnson's in there now. So, I think that's, you know, that's really the way it's got to be looked at. And when you're working off of a catalog of that amazing timeless music, as long as you and again, I think really the X factor with you guys as well is Kelly. I mean, if you didn't find a guy that had that energy and could sing that stuff like that, I don't think it would have worked.
Well, I don't think so either. No, it's absolutely, it is a great band and a great front man, but you're right, at the top of it all,
songs.
Is the song. And, you know, the thing is with Foreigner, the songs are more famous than the band. I mean, time and time again, you can run into people, you'll say the name Foreigner, and then, cold as ice, ding, you know, oh, yeah. You know, any one of the songs can do that to them. So, it's the songs are more famous than the band, and the songs give us the longevity. The great band with the amazing frontman, I think, delivers the product, and that you're right. That's what people want to see. They want to see these great songs that they love done by people who are delivering them with 150%, and that's what we do.
Last thing on Foreigner, and then we'll move to some other stuff. Obviously, we'll know soon, and I have been screaming as a voter for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I have been screaming for years now that one of my number one snubs has been Foreigner, the exclusion of Foreigner. And I've even talked to Lou Gramm about it pretty extensively, and he had some theories before the band finally got on a ballot. Now, I know everyone from Mark Ronson to Dave Grohl to everyone out there is pushing hard for this to happen. I think it's got to happen now. Mick has been obviously dealing with stuff. Lou has been dealing with stuff. We'll know soon if they make it. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame dictates and decides who actually gets inducted. And I know yourself and Kelly and the others from the current band are not being recognized. Your thoughts on that? Are you okay with that? Do you think it's the right call, or do you think they should have included everyone?
No, I think it is the right call. I mean, it's really the classic band that I think should be inducted and who deserve it. I mean, they're the ones that delivered those amazing songs and recorded and performed them. I don't have a problem with that at all. I would have a problem if they didn't get in, just because I think these guys deserve it. I mean, they're great people, and they were a frigging great band, and they were snubbed for a reason for several years. That reason is now gone, so we can at least be nominated, and hopefully we'll get in. Mark Ronson has been amazing about that. Hey, a little shout out from Sir Paul. That doesn't hurt.
That's right. Yeah.
So, hopefully we get in. And, yeah, I'm very okay with only the original band getting in.
Yeah, I mean, I I'm super vocal about all the Hall of Fame stuff. But, yeah, I felt it was the right thing, too. No disrespect to you guys. You guys have all carried the torch amazingly well. But the people that wrote and performed those songs on the record, I mean, that's what it's all about as far as honoring that. So it does make a lot of sense. But have you guys had discussions, like, if the band is inducted, and it's crazy that Foreigner wasn't in 20 years ago, but if this does happen, I'm assuming that you guys would have to be there to play, right? And maybe bring Mick or Lou up. I mean, there's been discussion about that, or you're not going to worry about that until you know if it happens?
The discussions have started. Mark Ronson is going to be the musical director for that situation. So I think he'll kind of dictate what happens. But yeah, I would imagine at least a few of us from the new band will be there. Mark and everybody are very aware that the credibility of the band, you know, is now hanging on us. So having us be there, I think, is an important aspect. But no decisions have been made. It is Mark's call, so we'll see. But my feeling is, yeah, we'd probably be involved, at least on some level.
Yeah, well, I've already put my ballot in, and, of course, you guys got my vote, and if there's any
and
sanity
you know, you
at
can, all... You can vote every single day, by the way. So go to the Rock Hall and vote every day. It's awesome.
Yeah, but and it's great to engage the fan voting, but unfortunately, I'm just being honest, the fan vote will not really, does not play a huge role in actually getting the band in, but it's a good marker.
No.
But right. I'm actually a voter, and I actually sent my ballot in, and I've been a voter for like 15 years. Tom Morello got me in, and I've been screaming about this, and Jeff, it's got to happen. It's a travesty.
Yeah.
It didn't happen 20 years ago. And again, you want it to happen. Well, I don't want to be morbid about this, but while Mick and Lou are still with us, it's got to happen.
Right.
I mean, let's get it done. You know?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And by the way, Eddie, I have a very strong gut feeling it's going to happen. So there you go.
I do too. I do too, because I think so many people were so vocal about it that that I think having McCartney and Mark Ronson and people like that, you know, out there, that I think does move the needle with them. And I really, really feel like it's going to happen. So I'm psyched for that. And we'll see. I think they're going to announce soon. So hopefully we'll get good news. Okay.
Yeah,
so
I think it's May when they announce something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, the deadline on the ballots being sent in by the voters was like early April, so they got to wait for everything to come in, but we'll know soon.
Right.
So End Machine, for people that don't know the story of End Machine, initially, and I hosted the first show you guys ever played. I don't know if you remember.
You did.
It was at the Whiskey, and I flew to L.A. to do it, and at that time the band was you and Robert Mason and Mick Brown and George. It was basically Dokken with Robert singing. But now the band has evolved, and you've released a new record that came out that sounds killer. That record is The Quantum Phase. So tell me about the End Machine and this version of it.
Okay. Well, yeah, you're right. Originally, the concept was, you know, the three guys from Dokken with Robert singing. And then, of course, right before the show that you hosted, Mick Brown decided to retire, and he wants to retire from playing. And he has done so, and he's a very happy camper being retired. So fortunately, we had his little brother, Steve, who is an amazing drummer and singer on his own. Feels when he plays so much like Mick Brown, it's kind of scary. And even looks like Mick Brown.
He does. He's in Tesla. He's in Tesla now. I see him all the time because he's in Tesla.
Right. And he is. He's a fabulous musician. But, I mean, when we were doing the videos, George and I kept looking at each other like, wow, this is spooky. Cause he looks so much like Mick. And he does. He plays so much like Mick. It's very cool. So, yeah, we don't have Mick Brown, but we have, like, the very next best thing, and that's Steve Brown, who's amazing on his own. And now we have a new singer by the name of Girish Pradhan, who is absolutely phenomenal. And this is not to take away a single thing from Robert Mason, who I still think is amazing, who is still a good friend, and I would never, ever say he did anything wrong. There's nothing that Robert did wrong. It's just that we made this this choice for Girish because the guy is phenomenal. He's an amazing writer, and he just brought some great new fresh energy to the project, and man, the band feels great.
Where does he come from? What's his background?
Well, he was it was Serafino that suggested it, and Serafino from Frontiers, you know, the label president, and he's Indian, and he's had a band called Girish and the Chronicles that play around a lot, I think mostly in Asia, maybe in Europe too, I'm not sure, but he's been doing that for a while. We heard we watched some YouTube videos and we were immediately sold. And the guy is just phenomenal. You know, this is his wheelhouse. This is the music he loves. And so for him, it was just such a natural fit to write for and to sing for. And the guy's vocals are, I mean, they're otherworldly. They're so good.
Does he still live in India?
He does.
So how's that going to work? Are you going to be able to tour? I mean, that's always the problem with these kind of project bands is pulling everybody together to do live shows. Are there plans to do live shows?
There's no plans, but there's a lot of pressure for it, and there's a lot of desire on our part to make it happen at some point. Probably not this year, although I'm trying to put something together for December. That would be great. But if you know, but the, again, you're right. The logistics and the schedules and the planning, all that stuff, make it very, very difficult for these bands to play shows. But having said that, we're working on it. And also, both George and my schedules are going to open up a bit in 2025. He's on his last farewell ride with the Lynch Mob this year. Foreigner's on its last year of doing the full 9 months of touring. So we will have a little more time in 2025. Fingers crossed. I'd love to make it happen. It is complicated. It's tricky with a guy living in India, but it's tricky anyways because of our schedules. So, like I say, fingers crossed, and maybe something can happen. But in the meantime, pour into that record, because I am so proud of this record. It's one of the best things we've done for a while, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, for people that don't know about this band, this is now the third record. So you've built a nice little catalog of original music too. If you are able to get out on the road, you could play stuff from all three records. Where I remember on that initial first record when you played, it was, you know, of course people want to hear some Dokken stuff in there, but
right.
you really just had the one record. Now you're building a catalog here with three albums.
Yeah, we could do a real strong show with M Machine stuff. Of course we'd still do some Dokken stuff. And the thing is, think of how well we could do it with this guy. I mean, it'd be scary. Plus with Steve in there, you know, unfortunately Steve wasn't with us playing live before. So now we'd have Steve's vocal in there and we would be docking on steroids and it would be pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And for people that don't know, you also, as if you don't have enough on your plate, you're a busy guy because you produce for other bands. You produce the End Machine. You produce a lot of different stuff. Are you working with any bands currently? Or are you producing anything that we should
I'm
know
doing,
about?
I'm doing Black Swan. Reb was here, Reb Beach. So Black Swan is another band that I have with Robin McCauley, Reb Beach, and Matt Starr. And Reb Beach was just here a few weeks ago. We got seven songs deep into the next Black Swan record. And then in a few weeks, he'll be coming back, and we're going to finish up writing that. Robin's already started working on vocal stuff. So there should be a new Black Swan record in 2025. But the other thing that I'm working on is we're doing a Costa Rica retreat. Now, this is my wife and I hosting a retreat, a yoga retreat, which we call Movement, Meditation, Music, and More. And that's going to be in Costa Rica from May 25th to June 1st. If you go to hotforyogascv.com, you can find out about it. It's going to be a really cool thing at an absolutely amazing resort called Selva Harmonia. And it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful retreat.
I didn't know that you guys were big into yoga. I didn't know that. How long have you been doing that?
I've been doing yoga since 1978.
Oh, wow.
My wife's studio has been there since 2015. And so I host a virtual meditation class weekly that through her website, which again is hotforyogascv.com. And I do that even from the road. I love it. I've started doing that in the pandemic, and it's been a wonderful thing.
You know, I know it's not the same thing, but there are elements of it. About a little under a year ago, I actually just started taking Pilates, believe it or not. And I find that's been super helpful to me with like aches and pains and stretching and
mobility. You know what? I started doing Pilates after my second hip replacement. The doctor said, you know, if you don't start doing something, you're going to be one of those bent over, crippled old men. So I started doing Pilates, I guess it would be 2019, and absolutely love it. I couldn't do it for the 8 months that I was down because I just had back surgery a few months ago. I started doing it again. And again, my wife's studio, she teaches Pilates as well. So, and you can do it online. So I do it from the road with the videos online, and it's been so incredibly helpful in so many ways. You're right. It helps with aches and pains. And it kind of stabilizes you. It helps make normal. So, wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I took a spill in Vegas in front of the Planet Hollywood. I slipped on something and I went down pretty hard. And I swear, if I hadn't done Pilates, I would probably be way worse, because I was flexible enough to do this split on somebody's puke or whatever it was and kind of bounce back up. And I'm like, shit, I'm 59 years old. There's no way that wasn't happening if I wasn't kind of like, you know, stretched out like that. But it's crazy, man, because like there's so few guys that do it. It's thought of as a women's exercise, which I never knew going into it. But I am finding there are some guys that do it as well, and I'm starting to see a few more pop up, and I'm like, whew, because I felt a little creepy in there at first, being like the only guy with like 12 women.
You felt creepy or happy?
Well, a little of both. No. If I'm being honest, a little of both.
Well, let's start a club, Eddie, because Pilates is frigging awesome.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I had crazy sciatica. I had to do muscle relaxers for it. All gone. No more. All gone. It's great. So
yeah.
I'm a believer for sure. And I know there's some elements of yoga in there as well. So it's cool to hear that. Yeah. Well, listen, bud, I appreciate the time as always. I'm sorry I'm going to miss you here with Foreigner, and hopefully I'll catch that second residency, but you guys have a busy year, so I'll run into you somewhere out there on the road. And,
I'm sure you will.
Everybody, if you're in Vegas, you got the first residency coming up starting tomorrow, right? Tomorrow's the first show?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's at the Venetian, and the End Machine's third and latest album, The Quantum Phase, is out now. Check that out. And one last thing before I let you go. Speaking of producing, I'm looking at the credits on the new album, and you had an interesting additional engineer on this record, a chip off the old block, maybe? Speaking of your family?
Very much so. Yes, that's right. That would be my daughter, Olivia Pilsen.
I've known your daughter and your wife, Ravinder, but I've known your daughter since she was very, very young, a little kid, yep. And now she is engineering. You're teaching her the ropes?
Yeah, well, a little bit, yes. I mean, it was partly tongue-in-cheek because she's actually an engineering major at UCLA. so there's a little bit of that. But no, when I have to go out and do background vocals, like in a group with people, she comes in, she runs the board, she tells us, okay, yeah, that was good. You know, she does the whole bit. And she's really funny, too, because she imitates me when she's doing it. It's pretty funny. We're keeping it in the family, my man.
Wow, that is awesome. Very, very cool. Well, Eddie, hold on.
I have to do my traditional shout out to Bob Dixon at Ample. I have to do that every time we get interviewed because I know he's listening. So hello, right. Bob. Thank you.
All right. Hello, Bob. Hey, listen, send my best to the family and hello to Bob and safe travels out there. And hopefully I'll see you somewhere down the line soon, bud.
I think you will. Thanks, Eddie, and everybody, check out Quantum Phase. I'm just so excited about it.
All right. Well, we'll definitely do so. Take care, Jeff. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Eddie. Bye-bye.
All right, man. Bye-bye. Well, thanks to Jeff Pilsen. Always great to visit with him. And thanks earlier in the podcast to Tom Kiefer. All the interviews you hear on this podcast happened live on my SiriusXM radio show, Trunk Nation. Be sure to tune in Monday through Friday, live 3 to 5 Eastern, noon to 2 Pacific, channel 103 Faction Talk, or anytime, live or on demand on the SiriusXM app. And be sure to visit SiriusXM.com/Trunk Nation for all your updates, how you can get the show, get a trial subscription, and a whole lot more. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Hope to catch you on the radio. And for sure, catch you back here next Thursday for another episode.